I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. A well-tended garden with beautiful blooms, foliage, and edibles is what most gardeners strive for. But gardening is hard work, and despite our best efforts, many gardening practices we use to create a beautiful garden aren't sustainable. Rebecca Warner has been gardening for over 30 years, and over the course of that time has been on a journey to create a more sustainable garden. Her new book is titled The Sustainable Enough Garden, and she joins us in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome. Good to see you.
Hi.
So how do you define a sustainable garden?
Well, my definition is that it imitates natural processes, it emphasizes cycling materials, and it minimizes waste and energy use.
So when did you first get introduced to this approach to gardening, and how did it differ from how you had been gardening?
Well, you know, I started out as a very conventional gardener. That's the way my dad taught me to grow vegetables back when I was a kid. And then I was on board with being an organic gardener, but hadn't really thought about this whole sustainability picture until the big bang was sort of when I read Douglas Tallamy's book, Bringing Nature Home. And that sort of changed my paradigm about what I was trying to do in the garden. Mm.
So you start the book chronicling your trials and tribulations with a compost pile in Newton. Many people have tried to compost at home unsuccessfully. Tell us the story of your compost.
Well, I'm hoping that you're right, that I'm not the only dummy who's had this experience. I started out my compost pile in the fall, and so I thought I'll just use fall leaves and layers of soil. And by the next spring, I'll have some so-called black gold. And of course, that didn't happen at all. The next spring, I just had some matted leaves. And at the time, there were sort of two things in my mind. One was there were still all those ads, which you can still find, that say that you can make compost using some kind of a composter in 14 days or 2 months or something. So I had unrealistically high expectations for how fast I was going to make compost. The other thing is there was that recipe for the lasagna compost. So you're supposed to have the strict layers. You'll have your green materials, your brown materials, and you'll store them so that you'll have them ready to be there in the right proportions. And I just realized I'm not going to do that because I have a life, because I don't have the room to store all this stuff. So I ended up with my lazy woman's method, which is essentially just throwing everything in the bin. And I found, actually, that after 2 years, I've got perfectly good compost. It was just my expectations were way off.
Just takes a little longer than what you were originally thinking. So now you turn it, obviously, and you just...
I don't even
you don't
do
even,
that.
You just, you know, throw it in a pile.
I just throw it on there, and after 2 years, I've got compost.
I like that.
If you wanted to be quicker, you'd turn it, and you'd maybe water it if it's really dry like now, but you actually don't have to.
Soil quality, of course, is the foundation of any garden, but you found that many of the conventional practices we think help soil quality are actually detrimental. So being a coastal community, many gardeners are familiar with the negative impacts of nitrogen runoff. What are some of the other downsides of chemical fertilizers?
You are probably boosting fast growth of your plants with nitrogen in a way that's not healthy. You're killing off organisms that should be in your soil. It's very hard to fertilize little enough not to have those effects.
So do compost and or manure provide all the necessary nutrients the soil needs?
They really do. And what we're... this, I'm sure, is not true on the Cape and Islands, but in the suburbs, we're kind of working against ourselves because we take a lot of our yard waste, including all of our fall leaves, and customarily send them out. It used to be trash when I first got my house, and now it goes to be composted by the city, which is great. But that means that that organic material that was on my land, I would be sending out for somebody else to make compost. It needs to stay in the yard and cycle. So those leaves, if they fall to the ground and decompose, or if I use them as mulch or whatever, do provide enough nutrients for what my plants need. Maybe if I want an extra boost, I can add some manure and the compost helps. Mm-hmm. but it's not interrupting that soil cycle.
Mm. It's interesting because for years, you know, you learn as you go, of course. I would put the mulch down on my garden and then thought, why am I doing this? It does nothing for as far as nutrients for my plants, but compost does. So I actually use compost as my mulch.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Even better.
Yeah, and then I don't have to do anything else. So you're right. It's really just grass and leaves. For the most
right,
part,
so,
yeah. As you began the process of amending your soil, you found that turning compost and manure into the soil wasn't resulting in the quality of soil that you were hoping for. So explain what was happening when you were doing that.
Yeah, I used to really knock myself out, especially on my vegetable garden. I'd be putting down a big layer of compost every fall. I'd be adding manure. And I kept thinking, why isn't this soil getting any better? I've still got the same sandy loam that I had to start out with. And what I learned is that when you dig and turn the soil, there are several bad things you're doing. And one of them is that you're just injecting a rush of oxygen into the soil so that the organic material is essentially like burned up fast. And that's why I wasn't getting a permanent improvement. So it actually works better to let your compost lie on top or whatever you're going to add. And the soil organisms will incorporate it into the soil.
So as it rains, it sort of brings it in, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Now, conventional gardening wisdom is to amend the soil as we plant, backfilling the planting hole with compost or nutrient-rich soil. But you learned that doesn't actually help the plant. Explain why and what's the better approach.
That was really interesting. It turns out that when you change the consistency of the backfill that you're going to put into your planting hole, the plant experiences that like being in a container. So we used to think, well, this is going to be great because our roots will have this nice fluffy soil and they'll be able to spread out. Just the opposite turns out to be true. They stay in that hole, in that nice soft soil, and circle around just like a pot-bound houseplant.
So what do you do?
What you want to do is improve your soil from above using your mulch or compost or whatever you're going to add. But when you are going to plant something, the backfill should be unimproved, the same stuff that you dug out of the hole you put back.
Wow. Do you know, for years I start my dahlias in pots with lobster compost, and then I put them in the hole.
Well, so that's a good question. Is that good or bad? What's the result? Do you like the way they come out?
You know, this year's been a weird year. So this year, I mean, some of them are fine and some of them not so much. But it seems to have, in years past, they started there because I want to make sure that they're all going to, you know, bloom.
And they are heavy feeders. They need a lot, right?
So, you know, I see, I go, okay, and the ones that don't make it, I just throw those out.
Okay.
And that way I don't have to plant them thinking, where is it? Why didn't it come up?
Yeah.
So, of course, mulching has many benefits to the garden. It helps retain the moisture. It reduces weeds, adds organic matter to the soil. You know, we're saying we're mulching with compost, not wood.
Mm-hmm.
You tried several sustainable mulch options. What did you find the most economical and suitable for your suburban garden?
Well, there are two things that I'm doing now that I really like. One is I chop up my fall leaves with a leaf shredder, it's a big drum with plastic filaments spinning around inside, sort of like the filaments that they use on those horrible string trimmers. So all I have to do is feed the leaves into the drum. It comes out shredded, small enough so that it won't blow around. That's really the reason why I'm doing that. So that makes really good mulch, but even though it seems like I've got an ocean of leaves there, that doesn't actually cover the entire yard. So the other thing I've been doing, which I had been reading about for some time, is using arborist wood chips mm-hmm. that arborists get when they chop down a tree and chip it. So we're lucky in my area that I can just call up a friend who's an arborist and say, do you have any chips? And he'll come and dump a huge load in my driveway, because otherwise he has to pay to dispose of them.
Yeah.
My sister lives out west, and she said they've gotten wise out there, and they'll charge you for the delivery. But still, I used to use bark mulch from like Home Depot or something, and I don't know if you've carried around those bark mulch bags, but they're heavy, and you need an awful lot of them to cover any area. So these are the two methods that really work for me, and that wood chip mulch, I find, really improves the soil. It's amazing how good it is.
Is it a certain type of wood? I mean, is that true of all of the wood? Because
I thought
wood chips didn't really do much for your soil.
Well, interesting, because there's a woman at University of Washington named Linda Chalker Scott, who's the only academic I know of who actually has researched mulch and done the test.
Wow.
And she feels that head-to-head, the wood chips are the best.
Really?
So one thing about that bark mulch, which makes sense when you think about it, is that bark has some waxy material in it, obviously, because it needs water not to get into the tree. So that is repelling water to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And it seems like one good thing about the wood chips is they don't do that. So your soil is nice and moist.
Mm. We're talking with Rebecca Warner about her new book, The Sustainable Enough Garden. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Rebecca Warner about sustainable gardening. You have experience with a suburban garden in Newton and a coastal garden on Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
So how have your sustainable gardening techniques differed in those two spaces?
Well, in our Martha's Vineyard garden, which no longer exists, we used to use hay for mulch, which worked fine. Some more traditional gardeners were aghast and said, how can you be putting all those weed seeds on your garden? But actually, if you have a pretty good layer, it works fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the main adaptation.
Yeah, I used that in my vegetable garden 1 year, but I found that, you know, as I walked through it, stuck to my feet and you know, dragged it around. So that was the only downside of that. Yeah, and that's true somewhat for the seaweed as well. But the seaweed really looks pretty, though, I have to say.
Do you have to wash it to get salt off it?
No.
Wow.
It doesn't. The salt doesn't seem to do any harm. Huh. There's been somewhat of a backlash against lawns in recent years because they take so much to maintain. So tell us about your evolving relationship with your lawn.
Yes. I mean, it's sort of an ongoing changing relationship. I started out with this suburban lawn and I felt that I should be keeping it up. And there really is a feeling in the whole neighborhood that, well, if you're not keeping up your lawn, you're sort of not holding up your end. You're not being a good neighbor. So I tried and didn't have a lot of success with the lawn. So what I've come to feel is that the less lawn, the better. And I know that some people feel that their way of gardening is maintaining a lawn, and they maintain a perfect lawn with total uniformity, and it's green all year, and it's weed-free. And that's just not my style. So what I'm trying to do year by year is kind of carve away, add more beds.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is I did learn that by removing the grass clippings from the lawn, I wasn't actually serving the lawn, that it would be better to let them lie, decompose in place. Mm-hmm. I think there maybe is a little bit of time in the spring where you could create brown spots by leaving too much clippings on, but most of the year you can just leave it there.
And for folks who want to maintain some lawn, what are the more sustainable practices that you recommend? I know.
Well, leaving the clippings on the lawn, cutting it as high as you can put up with like 3.5 inches would be better, because that just gives more photosynthetic surface for the leaves. I like clover. I don't know. Some people regard clover
too.
As a weed. But
It's green. It's pretty.
Yeah. And it's a legume, so it's fixing nitrogen. So it's adding nitrogen to your soil. So I think it's an addition.
And, you know, I don't really mind a brown lawn in August. I kind of feel like if you're on the Cape in August, you should probably have some brown in your lawn.
Exactly. That's the way I came to feel, because when we added an irrigation system, which in retrospect I wish we had done a little differently, I started to feel like having a lawn that's green through August is probably the sign that you're watering too much.
Yeah, I have to say I'm with you on the no chemical fertilizers on the lawns. And when those chemical guys come knocking on my door, they usually can't get away from me fast enough. Why would I want to put something on my lawn that the kids can't walk on, the dogs can't, you know? To me, that's as bad news.
Exactly.
But I guess, you know, not everybody shares that opinion. You embarked on a journey to incorporate more native plant species into your garden. What are the benefits of having native species?
Well, it was kind of a change of paradigm. I decided that I'm going to think about the garden as a community of organisms, and it's not just going to be me and the plants. It's going to be all these creatures that live in the garden. What Taomi in Bringing Nature Home brings out is that we've kind of got a crisis for native insects, and the native insects are kind of at the base of the food web. So if we don't have native insects, eventually we're not going to have all the food and things that we need. So these insects are evolved to use particular native plants, and a lot of them are specialists, so they need their exact plant host that they're used to. And if we're not planting those, if we're mostly planting beautiful plants from other places, then those insects don't have either the food they need or the place to lay their eggs or whatever it is that they need for their life cycle. So that's an advantage of native plants. Another can be that you've got plants that evolved in your area, so they're going to do well in your conditions.
Yeah, with minimal you don't have to do much. Drought tolerant and all of that. You recommend integrating natives into your garden gradually. Why?
Oh, that was sort of in the sustainable enough category. I had already stuffed my garden with tons of plants, and a lot of them weren't natives. So I wasn't actually ready to just pull out all the non-natives and replace them. So what I've done is when there's an opening, something dies, or I pull something out, then I try to make it a priority to replace it with a native.
It can be difficult to find native species in garden centers, and even if you go armed with specific names, there could be cultivars or hybrids that aren't native. What's your advice for finding native species that are suitable to your garden, and remembering that some natives can be invasive?
That's true. I learned that for sure.
We all have learned that the hard way with something or other,
You know, I wish I had taken more advantage of resources like the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, or right in my area in Framingham, the Garden in the Woods, New England Wildflower Society, because it is hard to find the native species that you're looking for. A lot of times I've found I came home with the genus, I hadn't gotten the species that I wanted. Now, it seems like the advice is that actually, if you're in the genus, you're probably okay. But I guess I would say use the resources that are available to you. But I hope that we customers are getting the message across to garden centers that we'd like to see more native plants.
I think we are starting, and there's some garden centers that are much better at
really
it than
good.
Others. And here on the Cape, there's a Cape Cod Cooperative Extension Service, which has on their website a whole list of invasives so that you can sort of know what you're getting into. And a lot of the garden centers have stopped selling, some of the things they know that are becoming problems. And of course, when we've had to deal with invasive species, many people just pull out the herbicides, including Roundup, to retaliate. What are some options to chemical treatments or invasives? What can we use?
Well, so depending on the plant, you might be able to suffocate it by putting down cardboard. If it's something very low, you might have to pull out the whole plant. Some people are so good about the life cycle of the particular plant that they'll just make sure that they get it before it sets seed, just varying on what type of plant it is. But I think in your home garden, you should, unless you have an awfully big space, you should be able to do this by hand and not have to resort to the chemicals.
Got any advice for bindweed?
Oh,
I know, it's terrible. And I just pull it and pull it, but you can never get it all.
That's what I've heard. I just read some advice that you should be able to hand pull it, but that's what everybody seems to say.
It's a
lifetime.
It goes deep in, and it just, if you don't get
and one little speck.
One little speck, yeah. Oh, I mean, at least it has a pretty flower. I'll give it that much, but, garden pests are another ongoing battle. We've come a long way in the past 30 years with more environmentally sensitive pesticides that doesn't mean they are completely benign. You did research about different pest controls, including those billed as environmentally safe. What'd you find?
Well, this is an area where I'm really torn because I would rather not use any pesticides. Where I felt the most ambivalent was when there were insects that are non-natives and so they don't have enemies, predators in our area. So I think there's no free lunch. There's no such pesticide that isn't going to do any collateral damage. So we're, in my case, for example, I don't know if this is true here also, but we have a big problem with winter moth, and we have a big problem with hemlock woolly adelgid, which specifically attacks the native hemlocks. So what are you supposed to do about that? For the adelgid on the hemlocks, you can use horticultural oil.
Like spinosad?
Spinosad is the one, that we use for the winter moth.
Yeah, that's what we use here.
For the hemlocks, we use this oil, which just suffocates the insect. So it's it's not attacking it chemically. It's just the oil covers up the things they need to breathe. So those are two approaches that are pretty environmentally benign, but not 100%. You're going to kill some other insects. You're not going to kill human beings. That's a good thing. But I don't, I guess my new point of view is I'm hoping that my garden can get to a point where it's a functioning ecosystem. So the balance of predator insects and herbaceous insects will be okay.
You know, when you have a healthy garden, generally, it can fight off a lot of that stuff. Now, the winter moth, I will say, for several years, I did use spinosad on my apple trees, and I haven't for the past few years, and I've had like one or two apples. Ooh. I've had like no apples. Okay. So that, I don't think my apple tree is going to get to the point where it can fight back. But, you know, it's sort of, you know, you have to, you know, I also worry about the pollinators. So if you're going to use stuff like that, you really want to read the directions, because you don't want to apply this when the bees could be impacted, or, you know, other pollinators. So you got to be really careful with anything that you use.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. We're talking with Rebecca Warner about her new book, The Sustainable Enough Garden. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Rebecca Warner about sustainable gardening techniques. Most seed-starting soil is comprised of peat, and I never really thought much about it, but we should be. First, tell us why peat is added to seed-starting soil.
Well, so to make a good potting soil, you want a material that's very absorbent, absorbs water well, that doesn't decompose too fast, and that has enough sort of structure to it so the plant will not just flop over. And peat fills the bill. But the problem is that peat, I used to spread it around like, you know, everywhere. I was always adding peat to my garden as organic material before I had compost. But it's not really able to be sustainably harvested. The reason is that it develops so, so slowly. So in a peat bog, peat is created about 1 millimeter per year. So how could we harvest it sustainably? And it turns out that peat bogs are a huge carbon sink. Peat bogs hold 1/3 of the soil carbon in the world, more than all the trees.
Wow.
So I just heard a news story recently that peat bogs are catching on fire this year because it's so dry. So it's a problem. When the peat bogs are either harvested or burned, the carbon is released. So my question was, could I have potting mix without peat?
And so you've come up with your own potting soil mixture without peat. So tell us what you use.
So I'm using the really basic approach, which is I combine some of my compost sifted so it has a fine texture, and coir, which is coconut fibers.
Oh.
So yes, it's true. Coconut palms do not grow in Newton, you know, so it's shipped from some tropical area like Hawaii. So it has that carbon cost to it. But the coir absorbs water just as well as the peat. And it lasts even longer than the peat. And it looks just about the same. It's a little bit, maybe it has a little bit more of a sharper coarse texture to it. But mixed with the compost, I'm finding it's working really well.
You know what I use in my window boxes? I don't have window boxes this year, but when I do, because they dry out so quickly, I cut up old sponges and put it in the bottom because they stay wet longer.
That's a great idea. I have to try that.
A little trick that I don't remember where I read it somewhere. If you don't start your own seeds, what are the other things to keep in mind when you're buying plants if you want to have a more sustainable route?
This was an eye-opener to me. I never thought, for some reason, I had the idea that, let's say I go to, you know, a family-owned garden center, that somewhere not too far away, there's a farm where they're growing these annuals and perennials, and I'm just buying them at the garden center, sort of like going to the farmer's market. Well, not at all. Of course not. It's a international business, and say petunias that you buy may have zipped all over the country because they were started in one place, they were grown on in another place. And then the garden center gets these little tiny rooted seedlings, and they may grow them on just to the size of where they're going to sell them. So it just, it does inv- I mean, maybe that's what you want to do because you want a particular petunia and that's what you're going to do. But there is a carbon cost involved. So what could you do? With perennials, they probably were grown on a farm someplace like Latin America where there's enough room to have huge fields of these perennials because the U.S., that's becoming difficult to have. So what can you do? Well, I guess the ideas that came to me were try to find things that were raised locally, like what we're so focused on doing that with food.
I was going to say, we know where our food comes from. We're asking those questions. So what you're saying we should ask the same questions at our garden centers.
Maybe things will change over time.
Our region, as you know, in the midst of a drought this summer, and even if people don't typically water their perennial gardens or shrubs during a normal summer, they might be rethinking it with the drought. So how can we determine what has a good chance of surviving and what we should water in these dry conditions? Now you can sort of look and see things kind of wilting, but there are some things that are more hardy than others.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this, how little thought I gave to this when I planted my garden, because I sort of took it as a given that I'll always have as much water as I want, and this summer is the wake-up call. As a general rule, I guess, plants with smaller leaves transpire less water, so they're losing less water, so need less water. Hairy, fuzzy, gray leaves tend to mean that they're losing less water. And what we would ideally do would be plant according to water needs, which I must say I have never done. But let's say you want to have a nice lush bed with your hydrangeas or whatever, but put those in an area together where you're going to be able to focus your watering so that, I mean, I definitely put the hairy gray leaves in with the hydrangeas, and so they're all getting the same amount of water, and that probably means I'm overdoing it. Mm.
You offer some tips on how we can reduce the amount of water that we use in the gardens, and you're saying first is like to group by their water needs, but it seems like I wouldn't know that. I mean, you mentioned small leaves, bigger leaves. Is how do you know that? Like, I have hostas next to my hydrangeas.
Yeah, good question. I wonder if we're going to eventually have ratings like we have climate ratings, where we're going to have drought ratings too.
Yeah,
that would be very useful.
Yeah, you recommend preventing runoff and trying to collect rainwater. Mm-hmm. What are some ways you've accomplished this in your garden? Because, of course, big concern is if you don't have it covered, you get the mosquitoes in it. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that can...
Well, I've just got two things going at this point. One is I do have a rain barrel, and because of the mosquito concern, it has a piece of screen. So as the water goes into the barrel, it's...
So the mosquitoes can't get in.
Mosquitoes cannot get in. But that's... This year is proving the limitation of that, because if it doesn't rain, you don't have
anything in your rain barrel. Yeah.
And in terms of preventing runoff, I did have an area where the rainwater was clearly running down the driveway into the street. And since I live near the Charles River, that's a particular concern, because as that water runs off your property, if you have used any pesticides or fertilizer,
it's going into
the carrying river. That. Yeah. It's carrying whatever is in the street into the storm drains and into the river. So I got this porous paving strip put in at the base of the driveway. It's only about maybe 18 inches wide. And you can see that as the water runs down the driveway, it just sinks into the ground. So that way it's going toward replenishing the groundwater and it's not going into the river.
That's a clever thing.
It is. It's a great solution.
When you look back on your decades of gardening and working towards sustainability, what's been your most gratifying experience and your biggest challenge?
Well, I must say that compost just is a very romantic process to me. I love the fact that you take your garden waste and you get this really great stuff out of it. So that might actually be my favorite thing. My biggest challenge is I've let loose, as you referred to, I've let loose some plants that are just ruling the world in my garden. And little did I know, because for the first 5 years, maybe, like, are you familiar with sweet woodruff?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I started it. I thought it's a wonderful ground cover. Well, by this time, 20 years later, it's everywhere.
Yeah, you're pulling it out.
You know, you made those decisions and you didn't really understand the consequences.
My lily of the valley.
Yeah.
Same kind of
thing.
Yeah. There's a reason people give you excess plants from their garden. You just, why don't you want this?
Yes.
And as far as community resources, do you recommend gardeners seek out any specific sustainability kind of gardening practice? Are there resources for that?
Well, Garden in the Woods is a great one in my area. I find that the towns are getting really interested in this. So, like, my town wants to give you a closed composter at a reduced rate. We can get compost from the town. So I would say check out what your town is doing, because mm-hmm. they seem to be getting on board.
Yeah. I think you have to be careful sometimes, though, with some of the free compost and things like that, because you don't know what kind of seeds are in there. And that's where I got my bindweed, by the way.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's like, oh, no.
So sorry
yeah,
to hear
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But then, you know, my neighbor uses the free stuff and her vegetable garden always looks fantastic. But I always get a little worried because you don't really know what's
yeah,
in there.
That's true.
You know? So I guess maybe if you ask questions, maybe they can tell you what's in there. Mm-hmm. Gardeners, of course, constantly evolving, gardeners and gardens. What would you like to do next in yours?
Well, I'd like to keep carving away at that lawn. So my dream would be someday I've really got only lawn where I want to walk on it and not big swaths of lawn. And then I'd like to get one of these underground cisterns to store water that falls on the roof.
Mm.
I wish I had thought about that sooner, but you can have, even in our area where, of course, we have to worry about where the frost will be, you can have a big underground tank that will collect all the water from your roof. And I calculated if I did that, that would be just about the amount of water that I'm using on my garden. Mm. So that would really make me feel better about the water I'm using.
Yeah. I notice in Florida they use a lot of gray water for gardens
yeah,
and things. And wouldn't that be great if we could do a little bit of that here as well? And yeah, it's funny, you look back, and there's so many things I would do differently if I started my garden over again. But I, like you, have tried to create all of these spaces where I have less and less lawn. The problem with it becomes you have to weed that. And it really was a lot quicker when I could mow it. But it's prettier. It's prettier. But yeah, sometimes the weeds get ahead of you.
Yeah.
Rebecca Warner is the author of The Sustainable Enough Garden. We'll have a link to more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.